Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso reporting. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Egyptian counterpart, Foreign Secretary Sameh Sukri, have launched talks on economic, regional security, and other issues as the two meet in the first U.S.-Egyptian strategic dialogue since 2009. The talks in Cairo today come at a time when Egypt is confronting growing terrorist threats in the Sinai Peninsula, some from militant groups that have claimed allegiance to the Islamic State group known as Daesh. Kerry spoke with the news media prior to the talks.
The agenda for our delegations today is very broad. It ought to be. It includes the threat posed by Daesh, which is serious. Just 2 days ago, General Allen met in Canada, the 22 nations. We continue to be deeply focused on Daesh. And we believe we're making progress.
Later today, Kerry will meet with the Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper dissolved Parliament Sunday and set an election for October 19th. Mr. Harper and his Conservative Party are seeking a fourth term in office after nearly a decade in power. However, they will face a tough campaign against opposition New Democrat Party and its leader, Tom Mulcair. Britain and France said Sunday that it was a top priority for them to block the onslaught of thousands of migrants seeking passage to England via the Eurotunnel. In a joint statement published in British and French newspapers, the British Home Secretary and her French counterpart called on other European Union countries and the international community to help curb the flow of refugees from Africa and Europe. "Our streets are not paved with gold," they said. This is VOA News. Malaysia's transport minister said Sunday that a wing part that was found last week on an island in the Indian Ocean has been verified to be from the same type of aircraft as a Malaysian Airlines plane that disappeared last year. The minister said French authorities and plane maker Boeing were among those to have confirmed that the so-called flaperon came from a 777 jet. He also said Malaysia is reaching out to territories near Reunion Island to help determine whether any other objects that may wash ashore in the region could be part of that missing plane. Kurdish rebels launched a suicide attack Sunday at a military police post in eastern Turkey, killing two soldiers and wounding 24 others. The local governor's office said the attack in Agri province near the Iranian border involved an agriculture vehicle packed with 2 tons of explosives. In a separate attack, one Turkish soldier was killed and 4 others wounded in the southeastern Mardin province when their military vehicle struck a landmine believed to have been laid by the rebels. The World Health Organization says work is moving ahead on a plan to reform the organization's ability to respond speedily and effectively to the international health emergencies. These reforms have been triggered by worldwide criticism of the World Health Organization's slow response to the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. The WHO's Director General is Margaret Chan.
Internally, within the organization, we are implementing faster, more streamlined internal procedures for procurement, for staff deployment, and the management of our global resources to speed up the response to any emergency.
Dr. Chan agrees with others that implementing these reforms will be costly, but she says she's confident the money will be found. Flooding in Myanmar has now killed at least 27 people and affected more than 150,000, numbers that are both expected to rise as the government, military, and relief organizations work to carry out rescue operations and provide aid. President Thein Sein went Saturday to the Saigon region in northern Myanmar, one of 4 areas where it's declared a state of emergency. Weeks of heavy rains, made worse by a cyclone that hit late last week, caused flooding and landslides that have hit the western part of the country hardest. Some areas have seen floodwater several meters deep. A Mexican photojournalist who went into hiding after being harassed was among 5 people found dead from gunshot wounds inside a Mexico City apartment. Ruben Espinosa worked for Proceso magazine, which his sister identified his body on Saturday. He was found with 2 gunshot wounds along with 4 women in an apartment in the Mexican capital. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clawty in Washington.
It is a task for the government to protect all the citizens, including the ordinary citizens and the top officials.
A Burundian civil society leader demands improved security for civilians following the assassination of a top army general on Sunday.
We want to see that the National Electoral Commission complete the task of making sure that every eligible voter is registered in the permanent voters register.
A Tanzanian parliamentarian demands the upcoming general election to be free, fair, and transparent.
Any kind of legal or policy reform is going to be ineffective if you're not going to be able to counter the deep-seated corruption and the logic of profit-making that has taken root here.
And human rights groups decry the alleged corruption in the South African asylum seeking process. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The assassination of an army general is creating panic and confusion throughout Burundi, according to the leader of the Forum for Strengthening the Civil Society. Until his assassination, General Adolphe Nshimirimana was a top aide to President Pierre Nkurunziza. The general's car was reportedly hit in a rocket attack in the capital Bujumbura on Sunday. He was a former intelligence chief and former chief of staff. Vital Nshimirimana told me earlier that there is need for the government to demonstrate improved security across the country.
We have been actually noticing that there is a growing state of violence in Burundi. And this has been the case from the time when Nkurunziza announced his candidacy to the third term. So now that a senior officer in the army can be killed in the street, this is a matter of a global concern from the population, because they all know that they are not protected.
Some people are calling on you and other people to petition the government to increase protection for the people.
It is the duty, it is the task for the government to protect all the citizens, including the ordinary citizens and the top officials in the administration, in the army, in the judiciary, and all the foreigners living on the national territory.
Has the government come out to say anything following the assassination of this army general?
The assassination of this army general was known early the morning around 10 a.m., so it is very early to have the official position of the government about the same. But we expect that the government should actually increase the protection of all Burundians and at some extent try to resolve the underlying causes of this violence.
Main opposition leader Agathon Rwasa has been elected as the deputy speaker of the National Assembly or Parliament. How are people reacting to this? Some people say that he has betrayed the people of Burundi who are opposed to the third term of President Nkurunziza. What are you hearing from the ground?
Rwasa did not explain to people his choice, and we deeply respect his choice. This is a political choice. But many are disappointed for during the fake elections, he concurred with other politicians to call for the boycott of the fake elections. And now we are actually surprised to see that he has lost a lot of opportunities for local government members, if he had planned to run or to participate in the elections, he would have gotten a lot of members of the parliament and the senators as well. So we are actually wondering whether he's supportive of President Nkurunziza, which should be actually too strange, because Gwasa is one of the key opposition leaders opposing the third term.
Supporters of the president appear to have been going after his supporters. So in order to save his supporters, he had to take his seat in parliament to prevent his supporters from being harassed, intimidated, and some attacked violently. What do you say to that?
It is actually not the matter of being in the institutions that could prevent people from dying. The issue is that the entire system is built on the ideology of killing whomever opposes the ruling party's ideas, whomever actually challenges the ruling party's position. So to date, we do not think that Gwasa and his 17 MPs will be able to actually challenge the ruling party's position within.
Vital Nshimirimana is leader of the Forum for Strengthening the Civil Society in Burundi. He spoke with me earlier from the capital, Bujumbura. A prominent Tanzanian opposition lawmaker has called on the Electoral Commission to implement new and improved measures to ensure the October general election is free, fair, transparent, and credible. This comes as the National Election Commission compiles a voters list that will be used for the elections. Parliamentarian Tundu Lissu told me earlier that the electoral body has yet to administer credible elections, which he says could make prospective Tanzanian voters have confidence in the country's electoral process.
Two things. The first one relates to the ongoing voter registration exercise, particularly in areas where it has not been completed, especially here in Dar es Salaam. We want to see that the National Electoral Commission completes the task of making sure that every eligible voter is registered in the permanent voters register. The second thing that we want to see is to see to it that the Electoral Commission supervises and manages the forthcoming general elections in a manner that will ensure that the elections are as free and fair as they could be.
We heard former Prime Minister Lowassa has joined your ranks. He's picked up presidential nomination papers to represent the party ahead of the elections. What does he bring to the Chadema political table that could possibly help you significantly challenge the ruling CCM party in the October general election?
He brings two things. Number one, he literally got CCM. Lowassa is probably the most powerful political figure in the country inside CCM until a few days ago when he crossed over. So he's crossing over not only personally, but he is coming out of CCM with a considerable support from within that party. You cannot win against CCM if it is a unified CCM. Where it stands now, CCM is broken, and this is the time to take it on. The second thing is, even though Chadema and the opposition generally has worked very hard over the past 5 years, we are stronger than we have ever been. There are still considerable areas in the country where we are not as competitive as we would like to be. Former Premier Lowassa will supplement our efforts in those areas where we are not as powerful as we should be.
Now, some supporters of Chadema I spoke with in Dar es Salaam, Dodoma, and other parts of the country that I spoke with appear to be displeased with the defection of Lowassa, who some accuse of being tainted with corruption, and that embracing him in the ranks and file of the opposition Chadema basically undermines your credibility of being clean hands to fight the supposed system of CCM in the election. What do you say to such criticisms?
I understand them perfectly, and I will say this before I answer your question. I was the author of the list of shame, which listed Lowassa among 11 other CCM members and senior government ministers of corruption back in September of 2007. So we, as a party, when we stand by what we said 7 years ago. But it is also true that following the list of shame, following that linking of him with the grand corruption around that deal in 2007, Mr. Lowassa was made to account for his role in that scandal. He resigned from the position as prime minister. 8 years have passed. He has not been prosecuted in any court of law. Our law and our constitution presumes the innocence of any person who has not been charged and found guilty in a court of law. So I understand perfectly those of our members who think that we should have done better, we should have kept ourselves clean. But if we want to win election, and this is the year, if we want to win this year's general election, we have to make an honest assessment of our resources and our support across the country. And the honest assessment that we made tells us that on our own, with CCM United, we can beat them. We hired a team of pollsters, very, very competent pollsters from outside Tanzania, who are telling us that with Lowassa inside CCM, we don't win. We want to win this election. Lowassa is the man who will get CCM. With Lowassa out, our pollsters have told us that we can take CCM on. So while it is very good to keep our innocence, as it were, to keep our clean record. But if we want to do away with the system that breeds and protects elements in our society, this is the time. We cannot deal with individuals. We need to deal with the system. We need to tackle the system.
Tundu Lissu is a Tanzanian member of parliament from the opposition Chadema party. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Representatives of Kenyans living abroad will meet in Kenya this week to discuss their participation in elections. Many Kenyans abroad are now seen as major pillars of the country's economy due to their huge annual remittances that help hold the economy together. Isaac Ungiri is a senior political reporter for the Daily Nation newspaper. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, to find out more about this convention.
This is a convention, the first one I think of its kind, organized by the Kenya Diaspora Association. These are a group that brings together all Kenyans living abroad, and this convention will be about investment and about representation. Last year, the Supreme Court ruled that the Kenyans who are living abroad should be allowed to participate in the local electoral process. So they will be here to talk and meet the electoral commission officials, including officials from the government, to discuss how this can be made possible, because the Supreme Court ordered that it should be implemented, and a roadmap is already being worked on how to have it implemented efficiently.
You report that the number of Kenyans living abroad is about 1.5 million. That's a big number. How serious does the government take their concerns?
When it comes to investment, the Kenyans living abroad, they've been actually taken very seriously because they contribute about 2% of the gross domestic product. Just in 2013, the last time we had a survey of how much they bring on board, it came out that they contribute about over 100 billion shillings into the Kenyan economy. And that is why when it comes to investment, the government take them very, very seriously. But on the electoral issue, representation, they have had an issue with the government, they have had an issue with the electoral commission, because there was an attempt to map them out, which a process that has been undertaken by both the Electoral Commission and the Foreign Office in Kenya. But rather than the Foreign Office managed to map to get about just over 1,000 Kenyans abroad, those who were able to respond through the portal that was created by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Electoral Commission attempt to do the same did not go far because most people in the diaspora felt that they were asking so much questions, so many questions that probably they feared they could actually expose them to maybe, you know, some of these people live abroad, but then they don't have documentation or they have become illegal immigrants over time.
Apart from the convention, you report that some of these people are going to meet the president of Kenya. Is that correct?
The meeting between them and the president of Kenya will happen later in New York in the United States when the president comes to the UN General Assembly later in September. So they are organizing a forum, an appointment with the president, so as to try to discuss these matters with them. With him and his members of his government.
So, you know, all in all, they seem, these Kenyans in the diaspora seem to be very involved now in what's going on in Kenya.
They are very much involved. They have a very vibrant association that is in touch with what is happening on the ground, and that is why they are sending about 100 representatives from all over the world to come and meet Kenyan government officials and other stakeholders in trying to discuss or mapping out strategies on how the issue of investment and the issue of participating in electoral activities in Kenya can be implemented. They will also be meeting quite a number of governors because, you know, the new constitution brought on board something we call devolution here. And a lot of activities, actually at the moment, we have a lot of activities going on at the county governments, and that's where these people want to try to find if they can create an opportunity for investments at the devolved unit.
Isaac Ongiri is a senior political reporter for the Daily Nation newspaper. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Corruption is pervasive throughout the asylum process in South Africa, says a report published this month. Almost a third of asylum seekers and refugees have to pay bribes for correct documentation, which violate the Refugees Act. Rights groups say incompetence within South Africa's Home Affairs Department is contributing to the number of undocumented foreigners who have recently become the focus of a government cleanup operation. For VOA, Gillian Parker reports from Johannesburg.
Asylum seekers and refugees experience significant corruption involving multiple actors, according to a report by Lawyers for Human Rights and the African Centre for Migration and Society. Refugee reception offices arbitrarily issue documents to asylum seekers and refugees looking to renew their documents, according to the report, which is based on interviews with over 900 applicants. Corruption is most pervasive at the Refugee Reception Office in Marabastad, Pretoria, with over two-thirds of applicants experiencing it. If you cannot pay, rejection is almost guaranteed. Kabelo Zedepani from Corruption Watch, a non-profit platform for reporting corruption, said extortion methods are evolving.
Our undercover operations are revealing new types of corruption that we hadn't kind of taken notice of. And these include corruption such as people having to pay translators or translators putting prices on the type of stories that they can sell you. So the more money you have, the better your story. If you don't have any money, we're going to tell a fake story.
South Africa is one of the top global recipients of asylum seekers and received over 70,000 applicants in 2013, similar to the number in the European Union or United States. The large demand on the asylum system has allowed corruption to thrive, argues Laura Landau, researcher at ICMS.
The argument here is that Home Affairs and the way in which it's dealing with immigrants and refugees is shifting from one that is based on law, based on policy, to one that is based on profit. If we're talking about reforming the asylum system, any kind of legal or policy reform is going to be ineffective if you're not going to be able to counter the deep-seated corruption and the logic of profit-making that has taken root here.
Corruption coupled with chaotic application processes increases the risk of asylum seekers remaining undocumented, If they are arrested, they could be sent back to the countries from which they fled. Gillian Parker, VOA News, Johannesburg.
In South Sudan, doctors at Wau Teaching Hospital have begun operating on the first of 40 obstetric fistula patients who had been scheduled for surgery earlier but had to wait until after Ramadan. Health officials say they hope more women will be admitted for surgery during this campaign. As Demo Silva reports for VOA from Wau, many women and girls suffer from this disabling condition and are being shunned by their communities.
Obstetric fistula patients have been admitted at Wau Teaching Hospital waiting for Dr. Said Ahmed, a surgeon from Nigeria who specializes in fistula repair procedures, to begin his work. Isaac Kleto, Western Baal Ghazal State Minister of Health, says Dr. Ahmed will be assisted by two South Sudanese surgeons who will ensure that patients are closely monitored for a month before being discharged. Kleto says he has the utmost confidence in Dr. Ahmed.
The main surgeon is a Nigerian surgeon who is a very competent surgeon, and the outcome was excellent, and I'm sure you will have a chance even to interact with the past patients that are operated, because we are going to use them again. We did not lose contact with them. We are going to use them to mobilize.
Kleto says officials will use this opportunity to educate women about the importance of delivering their babies at a health facility to avoid the risk of developing obstetric fistula. The condition occurs when a hole develops in the reproductive organs during difficult or lengthy labor. He says the campaign also offers a platform for discussing the dangers of early marriage, one of the main causes of fistula in South Sudan. Fistula patients usually suffer urine leakage, which often results in social isolation, depression, and deepening poverty. Some women who have responded to the campaign say they have suffered from fistula for 20 years or more. Patricia Asikiwe from the International Medical Corps says this counseling offers students vital experience in handling difficult medical situations.
Almost all the students have not seen a fistula patient before, all of them, and have never managed a fistula condition before. So it is an eye-opener. It is good for them as midwives and nurses in training, so that when they qualify and they are posted to the communities, they have a case of obstructed labor and prolonged labor. They know that they do not need to be delayed.
One of the government's main health partners, the United Nations Population Fund, or UNFPA, expects overwhelmingly positive results from the campaign. UNFPA program specialist Stephen Mauer says the campaign provides urgently needed medical and psychological care.
The fistula patients are people who are usually marginalized in society. They are poor, they can't afford health care and treatment. So with the partners that we're working with, like Women and Health Alliance, that's WAHA, and IMC, and also World Food Program, we joined hands together to carry out this campaign, and we are targeting 150 women to be treated and restore their dignity.
Dr. Edmond Sebit Wau Teaching Hospital's medical director says although the initial delay caused some logistical problems, those issues have since been worked out.
All the process from transportation of the patient from all the different sectors to the Wau Teaching Hospitals are free in charge. All the services here is free. From Awil, about 34. We receive 6 from Tonj and 3 from Rumbek. And the others here, Wau.
22-year-old Teresa Akur says she developed fistula in 2008 after delivering 3 children, all of whom died during childbirth. She says she has been living a close-off life ever since.
I have been staying in the house and could not interact with people. I hope after the operation I will be able to move outside to interact freely with people.
This is a third fistula campaign conducted in Western Baal Ghazal State. In 2012, 75 women were successfully operated on. Last year, another 80 underwent surgery. For VOA News, I am Demo Silva Aurelio, reporting from Wau.
is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, August 2nd. All but two of the qualifiers for the 2015 CAF Under-23 Football Championship have now emerged. The qualifiers are Algeria, Egypt, South Africa, Tunisia, and Zambia. They join host Senegal, which qualified automatically. Whereas Algeria picked the final ticket last month, Egypt, South Africa, Tunisia, and Zambia advanced this weekend. In their third round return leg matches played this weekend, Egypt qualified 6-1 on aggregate after beating Uganda 2-1 in Kampala. South Africa qualified 4-1 on aggregate after using home advantage to beat Zimbabwe 3-0. Tunisia advanced 2-1 on aggregate after beating fellow North African Morocco 2-0 in Rades, while Zambia qualified 4-3 on penalties after playing goalless in the two legs with Ivory Coast. The remaining two slots in the eight-team final will be filled later today, Sunday, when Nigeria takes on host Congo in Pointe Noire and Mali hosts Gabon. The three top teams in Senegal will represent Africa at the 2016 Summer Olympics Men's Football Tournament in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. The fourth-place team will enter into a playoff with an Asian side. In the 2015 CAF Women's Olympic Qualifying Tournament, Cameroon has joined Ivory Coast in the fourth and final qualifying round. On Saturday, Cameroon reached the final round on the away goal rule after tying 3-3 on aggregate with Ghana. The first leg ended 1-1 and the second leg 2-2. For its part, Ivory Coast reached the final round after walking over Zimbabwe, which withdrew after failing to secure the necessary funds to travel for the first leg. Both Cameroon and Ivory Coast will clash for one of the two African slots at the 2016 Rio Olympics Women's Football. The teams vying for the second slot will be determined later today, Sunday, when Kenya hosts South Africa and Nigeria travels to Equatorial Guinea. And from Malawi comes the report that Ernest Mutawali has been appointed coach of the country's senior national football team. The former midfielder was banned for life for leaving Malawi in 1984 to play in the league in apartheid-era South Africa, which was then excluded from international sports. Malawi's next international is away at Swaziland in the Nations Cup qualifiers next month, after which it plays neighbor Tanzania over two legs in October as it begins its bid to qualify for the next World Cup in Russia in 2018. Staying in Southern Africa, South African businessman and former political prisoner Tokyo Sexwale is considering running for president of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA. His spokesman said Sexwale had been approached to put his name forward as a candidate for the FIFA presidency by several highly placed personalities within the football fraternity. He is in the process of consulting, following which he will then make up his mind, the spokesman said. A close friend of the late former South African President Nelson Mandela, who he spent 13 years with in the Robben Island prison, Sexwale was a member of the African National Congress and was a post-apartheid government minister before moving into business. UEFA President Michel Platini has emerged as the early frontrunner in the race to replace Sepp Blatter as head of FIFA. Soccer's governing body was thrown into turmoil in May when 14 sports marketing executives and soccer officials, including several from FIFA, were indicted in the United States on bribery, money laundering, and wire fraud charges. Finally, following the conclusion of the national trials, Athletics Kenya has selected 46 athletes to compete at the IAAF World Championships, Beijing 2015, later this month. Three-time world champion and double Olympic champion Ezekiel Kemboi only finished fourth in the steeplechase at the trials, but will make use of his wild card as the defending world champion. World champions Asbel Kiprop and Eunice Som also had wild card but they guaranteed their places on the team by winning in Nairobi, Kenya, this weekend. Two-time world marathon champion Edna Kiplagat was among the names announced earlier this year on the provisional marathon teams for Beijing. World record holder Dennis Kimeto and Wilson Kipsang also feature on the men's team. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Clote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. I say anything else, do not go to me, no, not go to me, no, not go to me, no. Anything else, do not go to me, no, not go to me, no, not go to me, no. I don't change my name to God, I no more, I don't buy more to God, I say my market no go sell, God, and then we say I no go blue, God, them, my brother. Let them try their luck, my God go in, no my God go in, no my Lord go in, no. And it's a do not go to win, no not go to win, no not go to win, no. As you don't pass exam, no God you win, yeah. And then we say you no go pass, for God you win, yeah. You wake up, see today last song, no God you win, robbers they rob, they no see you, brother. They no see you, my sister. Oh yeah, better pass. Now God do we, no, now God do we, no, now God do we, no. And it's a land, no, now God do we, no, now God do we, no, now God do we, no. As my wedding day, now God do we. And he don't tell where you be fine, but God do we. See, we go pop champagne today, God do we. Oh, we go there, dancey, dancey, dance, cause God do we. Anything you win, I'm gonna do it. And if you win election, my brother, I'm gonna do it. Like if you win the contract, my friend, I'm gonna do it. And if you check the countdown, my brother, I'm gonna do it. And if your market's a little, I'm gonna do it.
Yeah. dear Bekumi, I deal with dear Bekumi. Nesorido, Nido, 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 I deal with Kumi, I deal with dear Bekumi.
Sunday Music Spot. I hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The visit of President Obama to his ancestral home of his father, Kenya, to Ethiopia, being the first sitting U.S. president to visit that country, and his groundbreaking visit to the headquarters of the African Union, these visits were hugely popular across the African continent. The remarks and comments made by President Obama was similar to those he made in West Africa when he visited that part of Africa in 2009 following his election as the first African-American president of the United States. However, owing to his emotional attachment to Kenya and with a view to his legacy to Africa, his comments both in Kenya, Ethiopia, and as well as the African Union, were hugely frank and touched on issues that would have been considered taboos in the past. Nevertheless, when you look at his comments, criticisms, and remarks, President Obama would find strong support across the African continent. For example, his strong criticism of corruption will find great support among the African people. Even though he recognized that corruption is a global phenomenon, the crucial fact that the devastating impact of corruption is greater on the African people. This may explain why there was so much criticism of his joking comments that African leaders should vacate office since they have accumulated enough wealth. Social critics in Africa believe this was an unfortunate comment since it was a backhand support for corruption. On the issue of equal treatment to female members of the African continent, here again, despite the struggle between tradition and modernity, African societies in general will support the issue of equal treatment between male and female in African society, even when you think about education. On the whole issue where there was total rejection is the issue of equal treatment for lesbians and homosexuals. Here, African culture, and perhaps not only African culture, you find that also in Asia and Latin America, are not at this stage prepared to accept the question of equal treatment. And therefore, those critics in Western societies that criticize Africa for having a retrograde step, they should not forget that their views evolved over centuries. And even now that they have a more liberal approach to the issue of same-sex marriage, there are pockets in Western societies that still resist equal treatment of homosexuals and lesbians. But the real issue of term limitation will be embraced by most African countries. However, there are members of the African elite, political elite, who do not accept the fact that there should be limitations. Some believe that this is an imposition of Western societies on the African political system. However, the evidence will show otherwise. We should not forget that although belatedly the colonial powers introduced liberal constitutions at the emergence of independence, African political system soon gravitated to what was called one-party states, and in some instances, precedent for life. But these developments created political conflicts in Africa that were followed by coup d'etats. So the more liberal approach of limitation was the response to that. And that's why one should support President Obama's call for acceptance of two-term rule in Africa, particularly as we deal with Burundi. No one should justify the way the political class in Burundi, particularly President Nguiza, for going beyond their constitution. Where the constitution supports two terms, you can support it. Where you have a problem, like in Uganda, then the political class should fight for two terms. This is the only way Africa can move forward. I thank you.
Thank you. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, lack of money is lack of friends. If you have money at your disposal, every dog and goat will claim to be related to you. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. The government of the Gambia has released more than 200 prisoners, including 31 jailed for treason for their alleged involvement in efforts to depose the West African nation's long-serving president, Yahya Jammeh. At the same time, several individuals remain arbitrarily detained or missing in the country, including radio journalist Alege Abadoule Cisse, who disappeared on July 17th. President Jammeh announced their release himself in a speech July 24th commemorating his 21 years in office. Among those being released were a former justice minister and former police chief jailed for alleged corruption and drug trafficking, respectively. Those linked to a failed coup in December remain in prison, although several of their family members were freed, officials said. Human rights groups have charged the Gambian government with repressive tactics for stifling political activism and dissent. In December, Gambia's eligibility was suspended for trade benefits under our nation's African Growth and Opportunities Act because of the country's poor record on human rights. The United States notes President Jammeh's decision to pardon and release at least 200 prisoners and welcomes in particular the release, after a lengthy period of detention without charge, family members of the December 30, 2014 coup plotters. We call on the Gambia to respect its human rights obligations and to release all other prisoners currently being held without charges for longer than the 72-hour period established in the Gambia's constitution. Meanwhile, the United States remains deeply concerned about the whereabouts of Mr. Cisse, the missing Gambian radio journalist. He disappeared on July 17th, days after being released from a two-week-long period of arbitrary detention, during which he was reportedly tortured. We urge the government of the Gambia to promptly locate Mr. Cisse, return him to his family and loved ones, investigate the circumstances of his previous abduction and detention, and hold accountable any individuals found to be responsible for violating Mr. Cisse's rights. The United States is committed to supporting freedom of expression and the rule of law, and takes very seriously this and other reports of abusive conduct by Gambian security forces.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.